Somebody asked me last time how you actually had class on Wednesday. It's a great question. When I looked on the calendar, that's a full day class, I think. So we do have class on Wednesday. So we have the Tomorrow Life Class after today. And what we're going to do today is I'm going to finish up with multi-electron atoms, talk a little bit about X-rays and then magnetic spectroscopy. And some of the stuff to do with that. And then I'm going to start in on nuclear physics. So we'll spend probably about 2 days on nuclear physics. And then I'm hoping maybe the last day I'll do sort of a broad survey of some pretty interesting topics that have been very important over the last 20 years in terms of our overall perception, last 30 years, 40 years, overall perception of how the universe has evolved and how things sort of fit together. That last piece will be a bit hand-waving, and certainly we'll not have anything on about that on the exam. The nuclear physics will be. In all of this, I'm going to skip chapter 40. I mean, it's important for some of you, maybe very important, depending on what you do. But, you certainly can read it on your own, but it's not something that's put in class. I'm about to arrange, I think I've asked, requested for a room for a Q&A session the Sunday before the Tuesday morning that we have our final exam. I think exams start on Monday. Yeah. So Tuesday morning we have our exam. So I'm going to set up a Q&A session that Sunday afternoon. So we'll have a room and I'm available to have any questions then. You can use both sides of one sheet of paper to write whatever you want on. It's sort of the same drill as last time. It's just, it will probably be probably not quite twice as long, maybe 1.5 times longer, 1.5 times as long as for the same. I might give you problems that require a little bit more in-depth analysis. So, I mean, no promise, but I will certainly be looking to see if I can actually give you a Fourier analysis problem and how to get the coefficients. So some of you may have been expecting this last exam, but in the end, it chews up a lot of time from exam actually. So didn't really feel good doing that, too. But I feel better doing it, too, in the final. So we'll see what happens. I'm going to actually look at it. I sat down, I promised at least one of you, I would send you an additional example problem out. And part of the issue is when you look at some of these things, they can get pretty intractable. So for a day and a half, I thought I had a good idea for a nice problem that would have been a good example problem. And then when I sat down to actually write it up and send it to you, I realized it got much more complicated, much faster than I had sort of anticipated when I looked at it. So I thought it wasn't actually productive to send that one out, and I was more or less out of time to do myself. So we'll see what happens. Anyway, that's sort of the deal on the final. Any issues, questions? Okay. So we actually are sort of at the point where we have a lot of basics covered, so we can really move along and have some fun with some various things. Last time we were talking about sort of the structure of atoms, and in particular we looked at the hydrogen atom, where all you have to do is to sweat for half of your junior year in quantum mechanics to figure out how this actually works. But all you have to do is put a Coulomb potential in the Schrodinger's equation and solve it. And so it's separable, and you end up solving it, you get a radial piece of the wave function and then the spherical harmonics which contain the angular information. And in the process of solving the differential equation, because you're in a bound potential, you get only allowed particular values. So just like what we've sort of seen with the Bohr model, we have similar sort of thing. And so only particular, the solutions only work for particular integers that fit into these functions properly. We call them quantum numbers. And here I just write down a few of the wave functions, and graphically they're quite different. The chemical properties of particles that happen to be populating these different orbitals can be quite different. It can be, especially if you have other electrons that are going closer to the nucleus, then you can have these held less tightly. You can see the geometry can vary. So there's a lot of things that you would find in a general chemistry and organic chemistry textbook. It's really driven by the geometry of these things and how they're populated. So the solution we looked at here technically is just the hydrogen atom solution. And one of the really fabulous things about the hydrogen atom solution in quantum mechanics is it's one of the few things that one can actually solve explicitly that is completely relevant in the real world. And it really works. Happily, the universe is more complicated than just hydrogen. So once you start adding other electrons into an atom, you have to know how they populate, and now you have a many-body problem, and you have the additional issue of charge screening and things. So it's a more complicated thing. So you don't find typically exact solutions for multi-electron atoms, per se, but you can use powerful computers and techniques and get very good answers for questions that you might have. And the kinds of things people really get excited about are energy differences between different quantum states that are allowed, because those are the things that translate into how light is absorbed or emitted, which in the end is how we probe the structure of an atom. And looking at those energy levels, I mean, chemistry really is a process of reconfiguring the atomic orbitals. And when you start adding them all together, you will get molecular orbitals. You can think of them that way as well. But in the end, it's really just a reconfiguration of the electronic quantum states. And generally, you'll do it in an energetically favorable way. So if you want to build a multi-electron atom, though, one of the questions that comes up is how do you add the electrons into these various available quantum states that pop out of the Schrodinger's equation? And within that is a bit of a surprise, because it turns out that the quantum statistics depends on the nature of the particle itself and the intrinsic spin which it has. This is impossible to see, sorry. It was discovered, much to our surprise, that you put atoms in an L equals zero state. That means there's no orbital angular momentum. So there should be no magnetic moment for an atom that has no orbital angular momentum. The way to think about that is that there's no net circulation of the charge, the electron charge in the atom, which you can picture classically as giving you a little dipole. So that's what gives you the magnetic moment. But if you prepare atoms in an L equals zero state and you send them through a non-uniform magnetic field, when you have a magnetic dipole in a non-uniform magnetic field, you'll actually get a force that depends on the direction of the magnetic dipole. And for L equals zero, you expect that atoms do not feel a force at all if they have a magnetic dipole, and lo and behold, you find out they do. And so it turns out that that magnetic dipole, the atom still is in the L equals zero state, so there is no orbital angular momentum in the atom, but the electron itself has an intrinsic spin, which has a little magnetic moment, which turns out to have two values. So what that means is the spin quantum number is 1/2, and you can have an M sub S, just like we have an M sub L, which can be +1/2 or -1/2. So the way to think about it is if you choose an axis, that spin can go with or against it. And the quantum statistics of particles with different spins, for reasons I'm not going to motivate for you, are different. So if you have half-energy spins, you call them fermions. Examples are electrons, muons, protons, neutrons, quarks. So it's actually most of the bulk of particles, neutrinos, that we know. And if you have integral spin, then we call them bosons. So photons, ions, W's, Z's, Higgs, there's a lot of other particles that have integral spin. And it turns out that if you have particles that are bosons, then in principle they can all go into the same quantum state. And if you have fermions, then they can't. And so this is very important in the statistical mechanics of quantum systems, because if you want to think about it, if you have a quantum gas and you cool it down, what you're saying is that the particles will all basically go into the lowest energy state that they can get into. And if you have bosons and you really cool it down, they can all go in the same state, which is something called Bose-Einstein quantum state. But the make in the building next door, but for many years people tried very hard to learn how to make it. Had a hard time because technically it's very difficult. When they finally made it, it was a Nobel Prize winning experiment. If you have fermions and you do that, they will basically start from the ground state and they will just populate every successive state that they can get away with. Right? But they can't all go into the same state. So it's a very different sort of thing. So to summarize, the atoms and the electrons in an atom are able to populate states that are determined by four different quantum numbers. The principal quantum number basically is the driving one, mostly for the energy, where n can go 1, 2, 3, etc. L is the thing that determines whether you have angular momentum. If you have a non-zero L, then the atom will have a magnetic moment as an orbital angular momentum. I'm sorry?
What is the orbital momentum? What is the atom going to have?
Well, depends on how you want to look at it. Okay, classically, you would look at it as basically saying the electron has some degree of circulation, so you have an effective net current loop, which gives you a little magnetic moment. It's quantum weirdness, which means you can't have just a continuous stream of different currents. You can only have specific ones. So that turns out that as the particular values are sort of driven by L, and then you get very particular the magnetic, well, we're going to talk about it in a second. The magnetic moment is driven by what incidental is. So it effectively gives you the orientation of that little magnetic dipole with respect to something. In quantum mechanics, if you really can't visualize it that way, right? You have these strange-looking orbitals, and all I know about those orbitals, really, are these quantum numbers and the distribution of probabilities. Nobody ever said anything about circulating. Right, so you have probability density, and all I know is that if you live in a particular one of these where L is, plus or minus 1 or 0, not 0, but one of these, for example, in that state, you happen to have what you would classically interpret as orbital angular momentum for that part. So you get some weird sorts of words in here which don't translate readily to the quantum mechanics. You just sort of get used to it. So the whole idea of intrinsic spin is like that. We have evidence up to extremely high energies that protons are exactly point-wise. We have no evidence of substructure up to extremely tiny distance, so down extremely tiny distance, at very high energy accelerator. That may change someday as we learn to build higher energy accelerators and can probe to smaller distances, but for now, that's true. So the idea of thinking of the electron at the intrinsic particle itself as having a charge distribution is sort of nonsense in that, in what we actually know. On the other hand, we know the electron has a little magnetic dipole that can be oriented with or against the field. And so the classical picture is that of a spinning charge distribution that basically has one mode of spinning and you can orient it this way or that way, like a little pendulum. So we call it spin. But yeah, this doesn't mean it's actually spinning. So you get some sort of strange inconsistencies that way a little bit, trying to take our common classical pictures and sort of force them onto the quantum mechanics world. Yes?
So that classical interpretation would the last thing sort of time is so if you were to actually make those distributions in space off of solve the time and
right.
Does adding in any sort of time dependence to give any sort of indication to any of the bodies in the path or
no? No. The time dependent stuff, to my knowledge, I mean, I don't do this for career, but to my knowledge, really gives you evolution from one state to another, that kind of thing. But these states are static. And so within a state, you have no information about thinking of the particle being in this lobe and then going to that lobe or whatever, because it is all a wave, and the wave just has this probability distribution. If you were able to do some sort of extraordinarily fast, strange spectroscopy and try to resolve it, you would find it always in different spots with the distribution that would look like that probability distribution. That's that argument you said. Okay, so once you realize that you have these different states and that you have such a thing as spin and the fact that electrons are fermions, you can then ask, if I have an atom which basically has these states available, and I have, it's a neutral atom, or it doesn't have to be neutral, but it has so many electrons, how would they typically populate those states if they were in the ground state? Then you can use the rules that I laid out last time to basically fill from the lowest energy to highest energy, making sure that no two electrons have the same quantum number. And if one looks at the ground state for the various atoms going up in Z, then the ground state configurations look like this, where this is the S or L equals 0 state for N equals 1. This is the L equals 0 state for N equals 2. And this is the L equals 1 state for N equals 2, of which you have, because L equals 1 gives you N sub L of minus 1, 0, or plus 1, you have available states of plus 1, 0, minus 1. And within each of those, you can put two electrons. So in each of these states, you can, in principle, put two electrons, one spin up, one spin down, one with N sub S plus 1 half, one with N sub S minus 1 half. And you have some strange rules that you end up with that are sort of, I don't know how to say this nicely, designed for chemists, because they're just sort of rule of thumb things to tell you how these things populate. You don't have to get into the nastiness of why they're exactly that way. But the you populate these three orbitals separately. I believe it's driven because they are spatially, that gets those electrons further apart. So you're energetically favorable relative to putting those electrons close together because they have gluon repulsion. So I believe that's what drives filling these things separately as you go up in Z. The spin up, I think the fact that you have the same spin in each of them, I believe is driven more like by spin-spin interactions. And we're only going to touch on it a little bit, but the fun is really just starting now. You now have this bag of little magnetic dipoles. Right? So this is different from that energetically. And if I put an external field, it gets even more complicated, and you have all these different pairings, and you have to sort of pairwise figure out what the energy is, so you can get all sorts of weird, fun things happening there. So energetically, it turns out that you are the system is at a lower energy if you have the three unpaired spins. But then when you shove in another electron, it has to go into one of the orbitals, and so it starts to pair up. So that's sort of the thinking. These states all have different characteristics. If you have other atoms involved, it is, can often be energetically favorable. For example, if I have an oxygen atom, well, that's a tough one. So hydrogen has this one unpaired electron. It turns out that it's energetically favorable if you have two hydrogens that will share their electrons, so that they both, in a sense, see two spin-paired electrons in the ground state of S equals zero system. But they're sort of sharing it, and that's the nature of a chemical bond between hydrogen. It's energetically favorable, so it turns out that that is the way in which you find hydrogen in the nature. It's H2, it's not H. You have to put in energy to create these hydrogen atoms. So there's a lot of chemistry in this. If you look at these configurations and think about how the energy goes, you can actually justify this curve of Z versus ionization energy and the spikiness, for example. So in the places where you have very high ionization energy, these are the places where you have filled shells. So for example, helium, neon. So this is helium, neon, argon, krypton, xenon. These are known as noble gases because they're very stable. Since they're energetically very stable systems for the number of electrons they have, you have chemical reactivity when the system is relatively unstable for its configuration. So things with single electrons sticking out, like hydrogen, lithium, sodium, etc., tend to be very unstable. In part because you have that additional electron that goes into an additional shell which is further away, all those inner electrons effectively are screening the nuclear charge, so this one out here is held a little less tightly. It's sort of an intuition that you can have about it. So out of all this comes a lot of what we know about chemistry. That's sort of where we stopped last time. Any questions on any of that stuff? Yes?
So why is fluoride so much more negative
than sodium? Well, fluorine is here. Fluorine is pretty reactive because it basically wants to rip another electron off of other things to fill its shell. So you will find fluorine, chlorine, whatever that is, iodine, are all pretty reactive. Yeah?
Can you tell if the spending number of protons, so you know it's not a what the number of protons are? What's the reason for the idea of the person saying to install the push shells?
Okay, so the question is, if I give you the number of protons in an atom, give me the shell structure.
Yeah.
You're going to get real good at that if you get the problem set and workshop this week. And if you don't get good at it, you'll find parts of the final exam rather than broken. Because I'm not going to give you the periodic chart and ask you questions about, you know, tell me all about zinc. I mean, I'm not going to do that necessarily. But I will give you an atom and ask for things like the ground state configuration. And then I might ask you to say something. I mean, I could ask you a chemistry question, but that starts to be really good. Not quite what this course is about. But you know, is this reactive or not reactive? Why not? If it were to bond covalently with something, do you imagine it would bond with two or three or four other atoms of this sort? Which you can actually think about a little bit, because if you look at these configurations, for example, I have to be careful. I mean, carbon likes to bind with four other things, and I would say it's not completely off to the spot. You're lacking four. So if carbon connects with four hydrogens, then you put an electron here, here, and two here, and you effectively get a full shell. So it turns out that carbon tends to bond with four things, which makes it a very good backbone for building long chains of things, it turns out. And that's probably why we're made of carbon instead of something else.
Three
maybe. Yeah. Anyway, so you can sort of begin to play games like that, but I mean, you do a lot of that in a chemistry class. So when you take chemistry, you'll see a lot of that. Okay. So other things come out of this atomic structure, and I want to talk about a few of those things. You can make X-rays. And remember that X-rays are just a region of the electromagnetic spectrum. They are very high-energy photons. But they're just like visible light, except the frequency is higher. They're very high energy. So it turns out that you can make electrons by accelerating... Not electrons, I'm sorry. You can make X-rays by accelerating electrons across a very high potential, something like 50,000 volts or something like that. And this beam of electrons and then bashing it into a heavy metal plate. Now, when I say heavy metal plate, I don't mean one that if you drop it, breaks your toes. I mean one that is made up of atoms that have very high Z. We chemically call them metals. They tend to be conductive because for reasons that we could have talked about if we were covering the chapter in solid state stuff, but we're not. So if you hit something like tin or some other gold or something, some sort of metal that has a high Z, what can happen is a couple of different things. One thing that can happen is you have enough energy that you can actually ionize the metal atom by kicking out one of the inner electrons. So typically when you talk about ionizing an atom, you're pulling off one of the outer electrons because it's not held very tightly. Kicking off one of the inner electrons when Z is very big, basically that's the four energy. Where Z is huge, under those is Z squared. So if you go, gold holds fits in an electron, the total is say 79. 79 squared more higher energy than the inner electron than the hydrogen. So 79 squared times 15.6 Z would be sort of a... So you get big numbers. So it's really hard to remove that in an electron. But if you shoot a beam of very high energy electrons at an atom, you can knock out some of these inner electrons. When you do, then electrons from outer shells will drop down, one of them will drop down, and when they do, they will emit the photon that is equal in energy to the difference between those shells. But that now is a very energetic photon because you calculated the n equal 1 and n equal 2 energy for hydrogen. Now you've got to do the n squared multiplication, which means this energy, the difference between these is very big. So this photon comes off with a very large energy. So it has a high frequency, and it turns out to be in the X-ray region of the spectrum. So just like when we hit hydrogen with a little electric current and we kick out electrons and when they cascade back in, we see very particular spectral lines as those electrons cascade back down to the ground state. You have exactly the same thing here. And if you look at the intensity of light coming off in the X-ray region, you will actually find special law. Okay? In particular, people talk about is that the K alpha line would be where I remove an N equal 1 electron, I pull it out, and then most often I'll have an N equal 2 electron drop down. And this will give you a photon, which gives you this peak. And it has the most intensity, which means that's what happens most of the time. Sometimes you'll have an N equal 3 that will drop down to the N equal 1. It will be a slightly more energetic photon because it started from a little bit further up. That's the K beta line. This is in wavelength, which means higher energy is going that way. Higher frequency is going that way. If instead of removing one of the inner N equal 1 electrons, I remove an N equal 2 electron, then I'll have a line where I have N equal 3 drop down to N equal 2, and it's called the L X-ray line. And it is now the lower energy because this difference is less than that difference and that difference. Okay? So you get sort of a structure. That structure sits atop what we call a continuum of X-rays that come off. And the continuum of X-rays come from a very different process. When you shoot electrons at high energies into matter, you don't really stop them, you just sort of piss them off. That's sort of what actually happens. They're hard to stop. What happens is that an electron at high energy going into matter, when it approaches close enough to a nucleus, it gives a fairly large electromagnetic interaction here, they can conserve momentum and actually emit some of their energy in a photon. And this is this type of thing is called Grimmstrahl. So if you shoot a very high energy electron into, say, thin metal, what you'll get is the electron will slow down a lot, but it will emit photons along the squat direction. And these photons are called Grimmstrahl. And if it's very high energy, these photons are basically X-rays. Grimmstrahl is a German word meaning breaking radiation, so it actually fits very well what's going on. But that radiation will come off as a continuum. It's a well understood and characterized continuum, but it's a continuum. And so what will happen with that is you will have an upper limit cutoff of the energy of the X-rays that come off, which will be determined by the energy of this electron. If I have a 50,000 volt electron hitting this metal, the highest energy X-ray I could get out of that is 50,000 electron. Right. So, and then I can get a broad spectrum of everything beyond that. When you study this process, you can actually predict what the spectrum is. So you get this continuum of X-rays that come off with these very characteristic lines that just like that they're atomic lines, just like the stuff you've seen with the gradients, but these aren't X-rays. So different atoms here will have characteristic X-ray lines. Yes? Yeah.
So I just might not really get back to the
line if you find that anyway. I thought we'll do it wrong. That's not it. Yeah, it's been a while since I looked at the actual Grimmstrahl spectrum, but we basically will kick off photons to very low energies, and you'll actually get more of them down there. It's just, well, no, they'll drop off. Okay. Okay, so now, to sort of understand this a little more quantitatively, we want to look just at the characteristic spectral lines. Remember what's happening. I'm kicking an electron out from, say, the N equal 1, and then I'm dropping an N equal 2 down to the N equal 1. If you want to think about the effective Z that an electron in the N equal 2 level sees, remember, N equal 2, you have a spherically symmetric distribution, if we don't worry about the L, let's say L equals 0. But it tends to be further out than the N equal 1. So effectively, the Z that the N equal 2 electron sees in a ground state atom before you remove this electron is sort of a Z minus 2. Because it doesn't see the full Z of the nucleus because it has two electrons streaming charge. When I remove this one, now it sees a Z minus 1. So if you want to think about what the energy drop from here to here would be, this is what we have with Bohr. So you sort of imagine this, but now the Z isn't the full Z of the nucleus, but it's Z minus 1. Because that's what this electron sees as it drops. And so if you want to calculate the wavelength of the characteristic X-ray line coming off of this atom, then you more or less have this with the differences in the 1 over n squares. So we've gone, for example, 1 over n times would be 1, and this would be 2 if you have the k alpha line. But the z you put in here is the z minus 1. Yes? Well, if you calculate all of this, you get 13.6 eV. That's a good number to know. You have to know one number, that's a good number.
Yeah. If you see what the power of speed is, you see what the speed is,
yeah, that'd be a good guess. I would do that. So for the L line, I would give you this formula off to this one, and I would think it might be, it might be Z minus 3, because you'd have the 2 1s electrons, and you'd have the 1 n equal 2 electron in there, and you drop them. You don't typically get asked to do that in the problems that they do, but that's what I would guess would happen. Okay? Alright, X-rays in 5 minutes or less. Next. Magnetic spectroscopy is an incredibly powerful tool. It's a wonderful tool for exploring all sorts of strange things with atoms. It's one of our main tools. Because these states with these different quantum numbers can have magnetic moments if they have any of them known. And you can probe transitions between them because states with different magnetic moments will effectively have different degrees of a magnetic dipole, which means when you orient them with or against a magnetic field, you'll have different energies. So things that look very simple when you have an atom free of the magnetic field get more complicated than you have in the magnetic field. So the simplest thing to think about is called the Zeeman effect. So you can imagine that I have an external magnetic field, and then I have an atom, and let's just think of this atom as having one electron that's unpaired in there. So you have an orbital angular moment. If I have a magnetic dipole and I put it in a magnetic field, as you know from 122, if it's oriented with the field, it has less of a potential energy than it does if I have it oriented against the magnetic field. So if I have something oriented against the magnetic field and I let it go, it will naturally have a torque on it. That's involved in calculating that a lot. So just remembering that, then in Schrodinger's equation, we have this V, this potential. What does the potential mean? That's the measure of energy. So if I have a magnetic field on the system, I have an energy term that I have to take into account. And that goes as the magnetic dipole of the electron dotted in D. So if you ask what is the energy change in the electron due to the external field, what you find is it goes as a constant times b times m sub l, and m sub l you can think of as giving you the orientation with respect to the field. And simplest to think about it when you have a plus or minus a half, l equal 1, because then you can have oriented width. I don't know what it means when you have 0 and then down. So it's a little hard to visualize. But in the end, quantum mechanically, you have the different m sub l's. And so this represents the change in the electron energy due to the existence of the magnetic field P. You will see many times a mysterious term called the Bohr magneton. The Bohr magneton is more or less the magnitude of the magnetic dipole of the electron. And it's given by this. Okay? And we'll just see things sometimes written in terms of units of UV. But very often, other particles that may have effectively a different thing here will actually be written in terms of some constant times UV. So the electron, you apply a magnetic field, what you effectively do is now change its energy, and that energy change depends on the quantum number m. So what that means is that if you think of an energy in a particular state that has a non-zero L, that state gets split in energy depending on what the various m sub l's are. So for an L equal 2 state, remember that I have m sub l equal to 2, 1, 0, minus 1, and 2, minus 2. So I get 5 different energy values according to what that magnetic field is doing to that electron. And a way to visualize that is here is the energy that I have for E equals 0. And the minute I turn on the magnetic field with a particular magnitude, that energy gets split into 5 different levels. For the L equal 1 state, I'm only allowed m sub l equal 1, 0, minus 1, so that gets split into 3 levels. So what used to be a very simple spectral quantum, which is one energy going from the L equal 2 down to the L equal 1 state, if you could have that transition, all of a sudden gets split into many different spectral lines because you now have lots of different possible transitions. They're not all allowed necessarily, but that's one of the fun things you can do with quantum. You have to conserve angular, for example. Photons have a spin too, so a spin pulse. And so you have to worry about these things, and that's part of what you probe when you play with putting magnetic fields and stuff. So the Zeeman effect, here's a simpler picture because here, for example, is the ground state, m sub l equals 0. Here's l equals 0. Here's an l equal 1 state. You split the l equal 1 into 3 different energies. So now instead of getting the single energy photon coming off in the spectrum, which would give you one spectral line if I was plotting frequency here, you'll get it split into 3. And you'll have a delta energy, which corresponds to the energy level difference between here and between here, which is that mu sub b times m sub l that I showed you. So you'll have the basic frequency that you have been seeing, which goes from the 0 down to the 0, which if you don't have a magnetic field, you don't populate this or that because you don't have anything giving you that split. The minute you put on the magnetic field, you split the spectral line into 3, and now you will actually see, and I can barely see it, so you probably can't, but there's a spectral line right here, there's a spectral line right here, and these are less intense. And the splitting is the same to each case. If I increase the magnetic field, that energy difference grows. So I can change the magnetic field and I can move these spectral lines effectively. Yes?
Why are they less intense?
That's a good question. It there's good reason, but I've forgotten exactly what it is. But, you know, it doesn't surprise me to see it, but I'm trying to remember exactly why. And I'm not coming up with good reason, so I'll try to remember to have a good answer to that number. So, is that what I'm going to do? So, Zeeman splitting is one form of thing that you can have an atom and learn about the structure of atoms. There is something which I chose not, I didn't prepare a slide, but let me say it so you heard it at least today. The nucleus itself also might have spin. If a nucleus has spin, and now let's say we have no external magnetic field. If the nucleus has spin, it also has a magnetic field. The electron naturally in the atom can't get away from that magnetic field, which means in an atom where the electron is in a state that has a non-zero interval, it will naturally have a very small splitting, excuse me, that comes from the magnetic field of the nucleus, that the nucleus has spin. And that's called fine structure. It's a small splitting of spectral lines. And it was a puzzle, and people didn't understand it until they figured all this stuff out. So you can get some very strange structure in this thing. In addition, the electron itself has its magnetic moment, which means the spin of the nucleus also has, and that then gives you splitting in the spectrum called hyperfine spectra. So there's lots of games you can play to sort of figure out what's going on with these atoms. So I'm not going to get into the hyperfine and fine structure so much, but if you hear those words, that's the kind of stuff that we think about. What I thought might be more interesting is to actually spend a few minutes on nuclear magnetic resonance. So, if I have a nucleus with spin, say here, again, just like we had a moment ago, I will have an energy splitting depending on the orientation of that nucleus with respect to the magnetic field. And that energy splitting will be just the same term that we just had. It'll be mu sub b. Maybe it'll be a constant because this isn't an electron now. Some constant times mu sub b times m sub s, where m sub s would represent the component of z of the spin of the nucleus along b. So for simplicity, a nuclei can have strange spins. I mean, you can have all sorts of spins in the nuclei. But for simplicity, why don't we just consider the simplest thing, the hydrogen nucleus. Hydrogen, the proton has a particle that has an intrinsic spin of 1/2, which means just like the electron, the proton can be oriented with or against the field. So it's very similar to what we just saw with the Zeeman effect. Except now we're talking about the proton in the hydrogen. And so if you think about what might happen, then if I have a sample of stuff that has hydrogen in it, and I apply an external field to this thing, then there will be an energy difference between the orientation of the proton this way and the proton that way. And that energy difference will grow with the strength of the magnetic field. And so I try to illustrate that here. Okay? There will be a lower energy state and a higher energy state, and they correspond to the different orientations of the proton spins with respect to the external magnetic field. If you create a situation where you have quantum states that are split in energy, if you can hit it with a photon that is exactly that energy, then you can cause a transition from the lower energy state to the higher energy state by the absorption of that photon. Okay? So in magnetic resonance, that's sort of the game you play. You take some sample of crud that has the type of nucleus that you're interested in, and you can actually do this with different types of nuclei, but it turns out one of the most powerful ones is just the one that, where you're dealing with the protons, because organic molecules contain lots of hydrogen. So you've got a lot of hydrogen in your typical stuff that you might be wanting to study. So you put a sample in here, and you have a magnetic field. And if you send electromagnetic radiation through the sample, and the frequency of this radiation corresponds, given the magnetic field that you have, let's suppose I have it right here, if that photon corresponds to this energy difference at that field, then some of these photons, some of these protons that happen to be in the lower energy state will flip to the other state. And when they do, they'll absorb some of that electromagnetic energy. And you can actually detect the fact that you've lost some of the intensity of the electromagnetic energy over here. So you can detect when that energy absorption happens. It's a resonance, right? A way to think about it is you can either fix the strength of the magnetic field and scan the frequency of the electromagnetic radiation, or I think what's more often done is you fix the frequency of the electromagnetic radiation and you scan the magnetic field until you hit the frequency where the same transition happens. Okay? And that's called the resonance. So you might ask, why do I care? Okay? Turns out to be an incredibly good diagnostic for telling us about the local environment where that proton happens to be. So if you want to imagine having a substance that's made up, that has protons in it, anything in the real world actually is like a bag of little magnets with little dipoles. So I might have an external magnetic field on a substance. The field that some particular atom sees is the superposition of that external field plus the superposition of any of the other little local magnetic fields that we have nearby from other atoms that have spin and dipoles. So it turns out that on average, particles that are in very particular positions of specific chemicals experience a local magnetic field that on average you can sort of measure. Okay? So what you can do, if you imagine now I have methane, which is CH4, it's a symmetrical thing, and if I had just this alone, each of these hydrogens effectively has the same magnetic environment locally, because of the symmetry of this thing. They'll all have the same environment, and if I now hit it with a certain frequency radiation and then scan the magnetic field, by putting an external field on, when the external field splitting caused by the proton orientation in that field equals the frequency of that radiation, I'll get an absorption. So if I want to plot, you know, the incident, the number of times things get absorbed as a function of the external magnetic field for a fixed frequency hitting it, what you'll find is if you have a methane sample, you will get a particular peak, okay, at a very specific frequency. What this tells you is that in methane, the protons experience a certain local environment of magnetism, which when you combine with your external magnetic field, gives them all the same splitting. Which means when you hit it at the same frequency, they all effectively will flip at the same time and you get the absorption.
But if you have a different structure, let's say we have a structure of a molecule that has say over here I have CH3, so these hydrogens all may sort of experience the same environment. This carbon is connected to another carbon where I have two hydrogens and a bromine. These two will have a sort of similar environment by symmetry. These three will have a similar environment, but these will be in a different environment from those. Okay? There are three of these, there's two of those. So now, if I hit it with a certain frequency of light, and I scan in the magnetic field, I will expect to see two different transitions. I have the same external magnetic field, but internally, they each have a different internal small local magnetic field that adds to it. So the actual magnetic field that is determining the splitting, the effective Zeeman splitting for that nucleus, okay, is different for these and those. And so what you'll get as you scan magnetic fields, you'll get absorption happening at two different values. And the intensity of this, if you look at the ratio of the peaks, you'll have 3 to 2. So this turns out to be an incredibly powerful diagnostic tool to determine chemical structure. You can basically take a very complicated spectra that you get from some complicated molecule, and you can infer from that a lot about the different environments in which you have present within that molecule, and you can actually use it as a fingerprint for the molecule itself. So it's a really powerful chemical technique. More than that, you can actually do this in real time, and you can do it with very particular spatial information. So you can play games like doing this in slices as you send a body through and get an image of where you get transitions for certain types of nuclei and localize it in free space. And so nuclei are very different, you know, different types of chemicals and things. So this is a way in which they can sort of map the body out. So that's effectively what a CAT scan is. I actually don't know whether bromine has a non-zero spin or not, but there are particular molecules that have non-zero spin, and if they do, in principle, you can do this kind of thing with it.
Okay.
Hydrogen certainly is everywhere in all sorts of molecules, but there are certain, you can do certain types of nuclear magnetic resonance, and the machine's a little different because the frequencies will be different, but I now forget the common types people do. Carbon 12 has no spin. Carbon 14 has no spin. There's certain isotopes that people can use. So one of the things you might do is radioactively label something with something that you're sensitive to a spin, and if it's preferentially absorbed by a tumor, for example, you could then effectively dye the tumor and identify it in this kind of. So lots of games you can play. So it's an extremely powerful technique that we're not going to get into that much, but I wanted you to see the basic ideas. So they talk a lot about this kind of stuff over in chemistry and biology and medicine. Okay? Okay, so now I want to start our journey into interstates, and I will start by talking about nuclear physics. And the first thing I would like you to all know is that it is pronounced nuclear physics. It is not nuclear physics. Okay? And I don't know about you, it may be just my thing, but it has always scared the bejesus out of me when we had a president who can't pronounce the word, but could destroy the world by pressing the button. Right? It just always bothered me.
Huh? What would be the expert?
I said again.
What would be the expert? So it's not an accent in these words.
Oh, it's how they speak. Yeah. I mean, look, where I grew up, I had friends who said, you know, would say, Mrs. Nano, or lots of people say X instead of X. Nuclear instead of nuclear. it's a common thing. I mean, they don't. I mean, it's part of the dialogue. You know, we have all sorts of different dialogues. So I don't really mean this in that critical a sense. But if you got your finger on the button, at least say the word right. If this bothers me, so anyway, I bring it up here because I would like you all to say it correctly. So if you grew up with a dialect where it comes out like this, try to say it like that. Okay. I will not. It will not hurt your grade if you say it incorrectly, but I will cringe deeply inside, and I will try to keep it from showing outwardly, but I do not promise. Okay. So, nuclear physics. Oddly enough, we know most of what we need to do nuclear physics now. The atom is about 10 to the minus 9 meters or so, 10 to the minus 8, 10 to the minus 9. With Rutherford scattering, as we've seen time and time again, you get, to explain the high angle scattering, you have to put all the mass in the atom sort of in a very small space and give it, that's where all the positive charges are. That's the nucleus. And you can, from the infer, roughly the size of it, which is around 10 to the minus 15 meters. I'm not giving you a history lesson. A guy named Chadwick discovered that there's more in the nucleus than just the protons. There's also neutrons. So the particles that we have to worry about right now are protons, neutrons, electrons. The proton is a positive charge, and it has a very particular mass that we can measure. And it has spin 1/2, so it's a fermion. Neutrons actually have slightly more energy. And yes, free neutrons are not stable. They will decay into protons and the electrons and neutrinos. But if you bind them in a nucleus, you can think of them as generally stable. So what do we really know about the nucleus? What we know is that if we are sending a beam of charged particles toward the nucleus, we see as we increase the energy, effectively it means that you can get closer to the nucleus because you can overcome the Coulomb force and get closer. Okay? Most of the time, of course, you miss, so you're just scattering off. But when you're headed straight at the nucleus, you can get closer as the beam that we use, let's say you have a beam of protons that we're shooting at a nucleus. That positive charge can get closer and closer to the nucleus as I increase the energy of the proton. And what you find is that when that energy corresponds to any distance greater than about 10 to the minus 15 meters, you can explain the scattering very well by the Coulomb force. Okay? And when I have enough energy in that proton beam that I begin to get as close to the nucleus as about 10 to the minus 15 meters, all sorts of weird crap happens. And so the picture that we have, and we know something has to happen because we know that the nucleus contains within it a lot of positive charge, all very close. All these particles are very close to one another, and if you calculate the Coulomb's impulsion between all these positive things, there is just no reason in the world that the nucleus should hold together. Right? It should blow apart if all we have is Coulomb force and gravity. So, right up, if you believe Rutherford scattering, then you have just shown us that there is an additional force in nature. And this additional force has a limited range because we know that as we scatter off things, we only see Coulomb up to a certain point. And that range is about 10 to the minus 15 meters. And then at about 10 to the minus 15 meters, it's an extremely strong and powerful force, right? Because it has to completely overcome Coulomb. So because we're so creative, we call it the strong force. Okay? So we have the strong nuclear force that has a range of around 10 to the minus 15 meters. And then experimentally, you can now play games. And so people do accelerator experiments and sort of probe things like the density of nuclei. And one of the things that we find, I guess I should have thought to show you, maybe I can even show you some of the data on this, but one of the things that we find is it appears as if the nucleus has roughly a constant density. Okay? So if you say that the nuclear density is constant, A is the number of nucleons, or effectively the atomic mass, then what we're saying is that A divided by the volume is roughly a constant. So I can regroup that, and it means that the radius goes as A to the 1/3. So the nuclear radius is going to grow as A, which is the nuclear mass, to the 1/3 power. And in fact, that's how you measure the fact that you have constant density, is you measure how close you can approach the nucleus with, say, a proton beam before you begin to get non-Coulomb effects. And that's a measure of the nuclear radius. And the fact that you take nuclei with different A's and you find that the nuclear radius seems to go as A to the 1/3 tells you that the nuclear density is constant. Okay. It is a whopping density. If you take the mass of the Earth, if it were put into something that had a density, a mass density of the nucleus, you would create a ball 140 meters in radius. So nuclear matter is very, very dense. 10 to the 17 kilograms per cubic meter. Water is 10 to 3 kilograms per cubic meter. Yeah.
Quantum
electrons go into the nucleus? Well, electrons in the s orbitals do have a non-zero probability of being in the nucleus. And you're going to calculate that in district 45. I believe that's the last problem. So you can calculate the probability of having an electron actually being inside a nucleus. And you can have weird things happen. It turns out that once in a while that electron will actually get absorbed by a proton, which will convert it to a neutron and change the nucleus. It's a process of natural decay called electron capture. And so it does happen. Okay, so we already know from Schrodinger's equation that we have an attractive potential, which we, for example, have for the Coulomb, for the hydrogen atom, which we've now solved. We found that you'll get only certain wave functions allowed, and those correspond to discrete energies. Okay? And so when you say you have a strong nuclear force, I mean, it's not a crazy idea to just look at that as an infinite square well with a radius of 10 to minus 15 meters. You've already solved the problem. You already know what the wave functions are. You already know their energies. You've already basically done it. Infinite is not quite, okay? But that's not a crazy idea. We don't actually, I mean, we're still trying to figure out. We do have various theories of the nuclear force, the strong nuclear force in man. But when this was really first coming out, you don't need to know a whole lot more. You know you have a very strong force that kicks in at a certain level, and now you can get a qualitative feel for what's going on just by thinking of it that way. So what do we know? Imagine that you have a very deep potential well, think of it as infinite, and it has a certain depth to it, maybe call it infinite. And we know that we have a discrete set of wave functions and energies that we'll have. And what else do we know? We know we have protons and neutrons in there. We know they're fermions. Since they're fermions, since they're different particles, you can think of each separately filling energy levels. These get adjusted a little bit because you throw in the Coulomb function, so these energy levels and these energy levels are not exactly the same when you solve for them. But they're different particles, so you think of these as basically filling, being two separate things filling the same bucket, if you will. But the energy levels are slightly different. Depending on how many protons or neutrons you have, you fill them in much the same way that we fill the atomic energy levels. You have to have them have different quantum numbers. You can put them effectively two to a state, because you can have spins up and spins down, because you have spins of s for each of those 1/2. So there you go. That's nuclear physics. And that's about all there is to it. Then there's some really fun differences. If we look at the energy difference in an atom between n equal 2 and n equal 1 state, generally speaking, I mean, when you go up to very high Z, you find that it's thousands of electron volts. Right? And that's why you get X-rays from the transistor. When you're down at low Z, like in hydrogen, remember, 13.6 eV, for example, is the energy of the inner ground state. So that's a decent order of magnitude number for things chemical, right? Configuration. And so if I have something going from one level to another, it will be on the order of tens of eV in energy, okay? One of the big differences between atomic physics and nuclear physics, I hope you've picked up on a lot of similarities already. You've got attractive potentials, you get energy levels, you've got wave functions, you have different energies. You fill them up, they're fermions, so you get these successful ones. Very similar. One difference is, if you calculate the difference in the energies here, because the potential, because they're so deeply bound, the force is so strong, the energy differences here are millions of electron volts instead of tens of electron volts. Okay? So why do you care? Yeah. I mean, what is chemistry? Chemistry is, I take a bunch of atoms, and somehow when I throw them together, they reconfigure their atomic orbitals. So every time it reconfigures, you can think of it as liberating potentially tens of electron volts. You do the same thing with nuclei, and every reconfiguration gives you millions of electron volts. And so this is why chemical bombs go boom and nuclear bombs go kaboom. Right? That's the big difference. There are other things that can happen. If I have an atom in an excited state, so I have an electron up in some higher energy level, and it has an opening down below, so it's going to make a transition to some other energy level. It makes the transition, and the energy difference tends to be given off it's always given off as a photon, as light. And part of the reason why that happens is it can't really do anything else. There's no other particle it can kick out that is at that energy. And it's not changing charge or whatever. But with nuclei, it's very different. Because I have so much energy involved in the transition from an excited state, so I have a proton up in some high energy level. If it makes a transition down lower, there's so much energy available that in fact I can do more than just create photons. I might just create photons. If I do, because those photons are millions of electron volts, I call them, they're in the gamma ray region of the spectrum. So if I have a nucleus, I signify it, I have X here. Generally you have the atomic symbol, whatever it is you saw on the periodic chart. You have Z protons and a total of Z plus the number of neutrons would be equal to A, so we call that the atomic mass. This is also called the atomic number. This symbol and that symbol have the same information. There's a one-to-one map in there, so it's sort of just redundant. If I have a given type of nucleus, and I have one of the nucleons, which would be either a proton or a neutron, up in a higher energy level, and it makes a transition down, it can emit a photon. When it does, that change in energy, millions of electron volts, And the photon that comes out is generally thought it's a gamma ray. Okay? But it's a photon just like it is for a hydrogen atom. No difference. But because I have so much energy involved, I can create other particles and emit them and make transitions into other things. So you can have games where a nucleus of a certain type, you can have one of the neutrons decay into a proton. So this is actually, the A stays the same because the number of neutrons stays the same, but you increase Z because a neutron decays into a proton, and the nucleus kicks out an electron and a particle called an electron neutrino. And this now changes it. This is now a different type of nucleus. But it turns out this might be naturally energetically favorable. It's something we call beta decay. And I'm out of time, but we'll start there and go through different types of decays.
Thank you.